Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Governor Romney's plan is really just one word. Patra. Backward. We need to move forward. Pa'lante. Pa'lante.
Cristina Sara Legui from Telemundo at the Democratic Convention last night, a very good speaker, kind of overlooked in most of the English language media coverage today. She is sometimes referred to as the Latino Oprah. Of course, Bill Clinton blew the roof off the doors of the arena with a memorable speech that left even his fiercest critics gaga over how well he connects argument and emotion and accessibility. Here's about 30 seconds to get us going today.
We Democrats, we think the country works better with a strong middle class, with real opportunities for poor folks to work their way into it, with a relentless focus on the future, with business and government actually working together to promote growth and broadly shared prosperity. You see, we believe that we're all in this together is a far better philosophy than you're on your own.
We will hear more from Clinton and Elizabeth Warren as we go. We have Jesse Jackson today from the convention. We have Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy. And our first guest from the convention today is also from our local delegation, New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez. Senator, so nice of you to take some convention time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian, again.
Did you have a favorite part of Bill Clinton's speech yourself?
Oh, that's a hard question. I think that the president is such a great communicator. He takes complex issues and he makes it very simple for the average person who doesn't have a lot of time to be thinking about all these issues to understand our views versus theirs. But I must say, between the comments on arithmetic and their view about the Republican view about that, we left you a deep mess. You haven't cleaned it up fast enough and just put us back in there. I think those are very telling. And of course, his connection to the middle class, which is really a big part of what this election is all about and the choice that middle class has as they approach the next 60 days.
Clinton has given five convention speeches now. 1988, I was in grad school and not paying that close attention, but they say he bombed. I saw the other four on TV, 92, 96, 2008, and last night. How many of them do you think you were there for?
Certainly the last four. I'll just say that, he rocked the convention yesterday with the truth. Just an exceptional communicator and a great asset for the president, for Democrats, as we have voters beginning to pay full attention to the election and crystallizing their own views and their choices. And I think he made it so powerful that, there's two different visions that we wake up to on November 7th, the day after the election. One in which Mitt Romney believes you're on your own. One in which they ultimately give tax breaks to the wealthiest in our country on the backs of the middle class. One in which students who are trying to get a college education faced a greater burden. And a different vision with President Obama, which is the opposite of that, that we help working middle class families and those struggling to get into the middle class. We give them the tax cuts. We realize that they are the greatest drivers of our economy and the demands that they have and the needs that they have, that the nation's future is dependent upon a world class education. And that's why it's not just about the individual who we want to be able to realize their hopes and dreams and aspirations. But the nation's competitive future depends upon it. That's why we're, had the greatest enlargement of the Pell Grants and kept student loan rates low. And it's also about understanding, that women in our country deserve a president who's got their back and who won't appoint people to the Supreme Court that would change their right to choose. These are so many different visions.
New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez with us. Have you seen Clinton get better and better as an orator? Thinking back to even his own convention speeches, I think this was by far his best. I watched probably every one of his State of the Union addresses, and I thought Clinton to Clinton comparison last night was incomparable.
I agree with you, Brian. Especially, you know, some of the State of the Union speeches I was there for as a member of the House before I came to the Senate. And some of them were very memorable. Some of them were very long. The reality is I had a taxi driver driving me to the convention center here this morning, and she said to me, "I didn't even realize it was 50 minutes. I thought it went so fast." And it's Bill Clinton's ability, which is totally perfected, to, one, look at you and speak straight to the camera and think he's speaking only to you, and two, to speak in a way that is so conversational, in a sense, that you feel you're in a conversation with him, even though it may be a speech. And then, you know, to strike these responsive chords with the electorate and to connect with them in a way that this president, Bill Clinton, understands my challenges. And if he understands my challenges and he believes Barack Obama is a person who also understands my challenges, then, in fact, I'm going to, you know, move in that direction if I'm on the side.
That was exactly the rhetorical argument, the rhetorical technique. And it's funny, Senator, about the length of his speeches. You talked about you maybe rolling your eyes as a member of the House when he went on and on in the State of the Union addresses. I did, and there was always those, you know, in the media who would, oh, here he's going on and on and on. But then we would look at the ratings the next morning and see that he killed it. All the way through,
yep.
The American people stayed with him in terms of television ratings.
Absolutely, you know, because if you take the speech and forget about the length, you see a series of issues in which he is connecting with the middle class, particularly, well, with the entire spectrum of the electorate, but he has a very unique connection to white, middle-class voters, many who are facing extraordinary challenges, and they believe, as certainly I believe, that he understands their challenges, and he not only understands it, but has a vision as to how we overcome those challenges and help them realize their hopes and dreams and aspirations. And I think that's the uniqueness of him.
I was there in person in 2008 for Barack Obama's speech at the stadium in Denver, and that, of course, was so memorable for the historic nature of it. First black nominee, hope and change. The Democrats were also so pumped to get rid of Bush after 8 years. But tonight the president has a much tougher environment in which to speak. People have seen him for 4 years. People are disappointed. There's an enthusiasm gap, even if they don't want Romney. And he has to follow his wife and Bill Clinton. So what are you hoping to hear?
Well, first of all, I hope he has his best A game on, because after Michelle Obama and Bill Clinton, he's going to have to reach his all-time high here. But look, I think what I want to hear is I think President Clinton laid the foundation yesterday. A quick reminder of what he inherited, a nation that was on the verge not of a great recession but of a near new depression, two wars raging abroad in Iraq and Afghanistan, both unpaid for, exploding the debt, a Wall Street and a market that instead of being a free market, which we support, was a free-for-all market where the excesses of large financial institutions became the collective risk of every American. How he met that challenge in beginning in January of 2009, turned the tide, still recognition that there is still far more to do, that we could have done a lot more had Republicans not used the filibuster and all the rules to impede progress. And then, most importantly, paint for the American people how he will continue to move us forward, how he'll help build that middle class and build this economy from the middle class out, how he helps young people be able to realize after their college education the opportunity for employment, how he ensures that women continue to have the ultimate right to choose, how we preserve health care for our families so that they're not one illness away from bankruptcy, and basically lays the foundation of what he'll do over the next 4 years to improve the lives of all Americans. And I have the expectation that he has not just a rhetorical ability, but certainly the intellectual capacity and the ability to communicate that in a powerful way.
New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez from a very quiet Radio Row this morning. I guess everybody screamed themselves hoarse last night. I played that clip a few minutes ago of Cristina Sadalegui from Telemundo, and let me ask you about the Latino vote. It seems like every poll I see, it's trending more toward Obama and more away from Romney. But with all the deportations and no real push for comprehensive immigration reform, can the president get the turnout that he needs to put him over the top in some Latino-heavy swing states?
I believe certainly that is the case. Look, for Latinos in the country, this election is the clearest of choices. If you listen to the Republican presidential primary debates, you saw the real Republican Party. If you look at the Republican platform on this issue, you see the real Republican Party. If you see the difference between a young dreamer being able to address a national convention here at the Democratic Convention and the statements they made at the Republican Convention, Latinos understand who stands on their side. And in this respect, on growing an economy in which the middle class can grow, which they have been a bigger part of, but still many are struggling to get into, they know that's Barack Obama. On immigration reform, even though we haven't achieved the immigration reform we wanted, to the extent that the president had administrative power and let dreamers begin their path to realizing their dreams, we know he's on our side. For health care, where we as a community were one of the largest communities without health care coverage, we understand what historic health care reform meant to our families. It's nuestro presidente. He is our president. And we understand that very clearly in this respect. And that's going to drive votes out. The Republicans, it's not just about the Republican negativity, which obviously turns off our community big time, because we look at what they say and how they act. And even all of us who are U.S. citizens and have the right to cast a vote or who were born here but are Latino, we get the sense that this is not just about those who are undocumented. This is about all of us in the Republican Party versus a president that embraces the dreams and aspirations of a community that is growing dramatically in the country. So I think he's going to be able to achieve it.
So Bill Clinton rocked at the Democratic Convention last night. Elizabeth Warren, maybe not so much. Here's a clip of the Massachusetts Senate candidate and creator of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau doing what she does best, taking it to Wall Street.
Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. And Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them. Does anyone here have a problem with that? Yeah, well, I do too.
So Elizabeth Warren was wildly popular in the arena last night, I know. And Senator Menendez, I know you want her as a colleague in the U.S. Senate to replace Scott Brown and secure the Democratic majority for another couple of years. But are you worried that she comes off as too ideological and too polarizing a figure?
No, I don't. I think as I travel New Jersey, Brian, and I've traveled the country, I often have people come up to me and say, Senator, I don't get it. When I make a mistake, I have to pay for my mistakes. And when they, meaning the large financial institutions that brought us on the verge of a new depression in 2008, make a mistake, I got to pay for their mistakes. And I think Elizabeth Warren talked about, her view that, in fact, this is standing on the side of the little guy. It's standing on the everyday American. Standing on the side of the everyday American. And what she said is not antithetical, for example, to what Bill Clinton said. What she said is, look, we want everybody to play by the rules. We want prosperity. And we enjoy and applaud success. But you cannot take your maybe disproportionate power and abuse consumers. And when she mentioned credit card companies, something that I was a leader on the Senate Banking Committee on credit card reform, and how, in fact, that new financial institution made a difference to all of those who were being abused by a specific company and got millions reimbursed to those consumers. I think that's a powerful message. So this is not so much ideological as it is about whose side do you stand on? And I think standing on the side of consumers, standing on the side of families, standing on the side of those who struggle every day to make their family's dreams possible is very much not an elitist thing, but very much in sync with the hopes of those families.
Senator, our next segment is going to be a closer look at the embarrassment of changing the platform mid-convention to embrace Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and insert the phrase God-given potential, so God is mentioned at least once in the platform. Can I get your reaction to that?
Well, look, you know, in both cases, in my view, should have been in from the very beginning. I'm not sure that the president's people had, you know, their eye on the ball all the time during the whole platform process. But I admire that the president personally intervened and said, look, we need God in our platform, and we also need to recognize what I think has been historically recognized, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. When I go visit Israel, where do I meet the prime minister? In Jerusalem. Where do I meet the wide range of the public officials? Where do I meet the Knesset members? I meet them in Jerusalem. Where do all religions ultimately get to go and visit all of the holy sites meaningful to them? You know, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to me, and the Dome of the Rock to others, and, you know, the Temple Mount. When Israel had administration, has had administration over Jerusalem, that's when it was opened up to all faiths. So I'm glad to see that it was done. I never really doubted that that was the view of the president or the party. And so, you know, I think it's not the major thing that others are trying to drive.
You said God should be in the Democratic Party platform. You probably know the old joke. Now that they have prayer in schools, I can pray for smaller class sizes and great teachers and decent funding for my education. So why does God need to be in a civic platform from a political party?
Well, look, you know, if you take out, you know, one of your dollars from your pocket, you're even there going to see the statement, "In God we trust." You know, this is simply a recognition. God as, you know, the faith that everybody has, no matter what their faith is. And so, you know, I think it's an acknowledgement, particularly of our religious freedom in this country, you know, that we are free to choose how we worship, at what altar we worship. And so I think it's an expression of an almighty, and however you may worship that almighty, it is permeated throughout our history as a country.
Last thing on this, Mayor Booker is head of the platform committee. Is this his fault?
No, I don't put it. Mayor Booker is, you know, the be-all and end-all of the platform. There's a lot of different moving parts in a platform process. There's a lot of drafters. There's the whole set of sessions and hearings. There's the final writers of it. I'm not sure that everybody reads every element of it. Certainly, I don't think Mayor Booker had that opportunity. I think he was representing the broader, you know, elements of what the vision of President Obama and Democrats are for this country. I've heard Mayor Booker in many speeches, and on both of those issues, he's been exactly where our platform now stands.
Right. Last thing, Senator, no matter who is elected president, what would you want from him to help New Jersey's economy, which has, I think, the fourth highest unemployment rate in the nation right now?
Well, I'd like to obviously be able to move some of the initiatives, some of which I authored, that Republicans rejected to the filibuster in the Senate. You know, our state is a state that is driven by innovation. I'm proud, for example, of the $52 million that I bought for 133 small biotech firms in our state. I'm proud of our being the number one solar installation in the nation as a result of my solar energy tax credits. I want to drive education, innovation, investment in transportation, which is critical to our state and our region. And those elements are going to continue to drive our economy in the life science field, in the energy field, and in the human capital that I consistently listen to companies who have jobs available but can't fill them with the human capital they're looking for. So I think the president was foursquare. President Clinton was foursquare last night when he said, we have, you know, a lot of jobs out there. We've got to make sure we educate and train individuals for those jobs as we create new jobs. All of those things would drive the economy in New Jersey.
Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, live from the Democratic Convention. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll take a closer look at the Democratic platform controversy over embracing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and inserting God into the platform as in God-given potential. Stay with us. Dennis Kucinich among our guests for this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now let's take a closer look at the controversy that engulfed the convention yesterday over two items in the party platform. They changed the platform yesterday in the middle of the convention to include the word God and to include a recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. In a few minutes, we'll talk live to Jane Eisner, editor of the Jewish newspaper The Forward. First, just after this vote was taken yesterday afternoon, I was recording an interview with Ohio Congressman and former presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich. So I asked for his reaction to both the Jerusalem part and inserting that the Democrats want to help people realize their God-given potential, inserting the word God, which had not previously appeared in the Democratic platform this year. There are 12 references to God in the Republican platform. So now the Democrats have God-given potential as their one. And from Congressman Kucinich on both God and Jerusalem, I got an earful.
You know, if I was in the Knesset, could I put in a bill to make Cleveland the capital of the United States? And if I did, who would care? I don't think that we have a right to determine what the capital of Israel is. That's number one. And number two, the matter of God. You know, our motto from the 50s, "In God We Trust," is still there. We have to remember not to confuse religion with spirituality. Spirituality deals with ethical underpinnings, with morality, with high ideals. Religion might be something else. And so the mention of God in and of itself, I don't think, is particularly offensive. And for those who are atheists, we need to respect that. And there is a, you know, we need to, the problem is when God is used as someone tries to make God their running mate. I mean, come on. this is a, you know, if we're talking about a universal principle, everybody partakes in it. The underlying principle of the United States, e pluribus unum, out of many we are one, is human unity. And if you're looking at the principle of God, it has to do with everything, with all things, with the world being interconnected and interdependent. And the minute that we get in dichotomies, of Republican versus Democrat, of Catholic versus Muslim, Baptist, Jew, whatever, the minute you get into the dichotomies of race, even the dichotomies of income, you get into a place where the idea is, well, my God's bigger than your God. No. We have to get away. We have to practice mutual understanding and tolerance, and also exercise the spiritual principles which we, some of us, you know, want to articulate. But how about jobs for all? That's a spiritual principle. You know, how about health care for all? That's a spiritual principle. How about peace? Let's try that. We believe in peace. Well, that's a spiritual principle. So, you know, if people want to put God on their bumper sticker. That's their business. But this really has to do more with what one's personal relationship is with spirituality and how you connect it to your sense of purpose and ethics in the world.
Back to Jerusalem for just a second. You said it shouldn't be up to
next
the United
year in
States.
Jerusalem.
Every Passover, they say. But
right.
Shouldn't be up to the United States, you said, to say what the capital of Israel is. It should be up to Israel.
Right.
Doesn't this plank just support Israel's right to determine that its capital is Jerusalem?
Israel has the right. So what's the point in saying it? I mean, why state the obvious? And so the point is, look, the Democrats want to make a strong statement of support for Israel. Well, that's nothing new. I mean, I would like to see a statement of support for the Palestinians. And I think I can say that without in any way compromising my belief that Israel as a state has a right, is a friend, has a right to survive, and that we need to be involved in that. But let's not forget about the Palestinians, about their right, about how their rights have been usurped, about the settlement building, about the violation of their human rights. We should be able to have that discussion simultaneously and not force the country to make choices. Just put it on the table. These are two truths. And then the reconciling of those truths is about the work of our nation to achieve peace and justice between peoples who really have a lot more in common than one would imagine.
Through this whole flap at the convention, does the party look hostile to Israel, hostile to religion, and susceptible to conservative backlash all at the same time?
Well, no. I think the party looks like Democrats. This is what Democrats do. You know, we engage in mutually contradictory positions simultaneously. It's the acrobatics of a convention. There are, you know, the Democrats are committed to Israel. The Democrats should take a stand as to what, you know, what are the, we should have a discussion in this country beyond party. Are there spiritual underpinnings to this country? You know, when you look at a dollar bill, you look at the at the dollar bill, it has the seal of the United States of America, and one part of the seal deals with there's a new series of ages, and the other part in Latin, and the other part says he has favored our undertaking. I think it's annuit cheptis are the words. Well, what does that mean? It means that those who were involved in designing the seal of the United States, which is our official seal, felt that there was something about the United States journey that was favored by divine providence. Now, look. You can believe it's God. You can believe in some universal force. You don't have to believe in anything. But we have to understand that there is a historic tradition here of connection. What we have to be careful of is saying that it's reposed in any particular political party or in any particular religion. Give people a chance to identify it with respect to their own personal relationship and don't have government interfering and trying to say, ah, this is what it is. No, you know, we can't say that. But to recognize it as a force and a factor in our life, hey, look, when I'm voting in the House of Representatives, I look at the speaker's rostrum. Above his head are the words, "In God we trust." Now, I don't see a sign under that that says all others pay cash. I think what it means is that we have a connection in something that's transcendent. And you know what? As a nation, we sure should have a connection with something that transcends our experience. Because if we don't, if we ignore that there's another dimension out there, that there's an unseen dimension that has that where their events, human events, are somehow guided or impacted. If we ignore that, then we're ignoring the really deeper power that belongs to America. And I'm saying this not as some holy Joe. I'm saying this as someone who understands that America has a spiritual destiny, and we should not be, you know, afraid to talk about it. And we should be have a discussion about it, because if we did, we wouldn't be bombing people all over the world. We wouldn't be threatening people with A-bombs. We'd care for the environment. We'd care for every individual. We'd make sure that every human life was valued. I mean, these are things we should be able to do. And we protect all women's rights as symbolic of Mother Earth, protecting Mother Earth herself. So, you know, it's great to be here. This is a time when we should be talking about ideals and ideas, but also understand this. The political process should exist to implement ideas and ideals, not just for the same old. And frankly, right now, I'm not impressed with the politics of either party. I'm a Democrat. I'm going to support the president. But boy, do we have a long way to go. We have a mountain to climb, but we have the capacity to do it. And that's what Michelle Obama's speech was about. So all these contradictions are point to great potential and also disappointment for some. But I prefer to look at it as the distance we still are to travel. And as one Supreme Court justice once said, we just fix our our eye on the point that we want to get to and work very hard to get there if we can.
Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Dennis Kucinich on God, Jerusalem, and the Democratic Platform in a conversation we recorded yesterday afternoon from the Democratic Convention. Listeners, are you following the ins and outs of the platform controversy? How much does it matter to you if the word God and not just faith appear in the document, or that the Democrats are on the record supporting Jerusalem as the capital of Israel? Does this whole thing ring either way to you, leave any kind of a taste in your mouth? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And for more on the platform changes, I'm joined now by Jane Eisner, editor of the Jewish Daily Forward. Hi, Jane. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So unlike the Republicans, who were having to explain why their platform included stances on abortion above and beyond the candidates' views, the Democrats were having to explain these two items missing from the 2012 platform. Again, any reference to God and these sentences that had been there in 2004 and 2008, quote, Jerusalem and is and will remain the capital of Israel. The parties have agreed that Jerusalem is a matter for final status negotiations. It should remain an undivided city accessible to people of all faiths, unquote. So, Jane, when did the world kind of wake up to the fact that this change had been made, that it wasn't in the platform? When Cory Booker presented the platform originally, he was met by thunderous applause from the delegates.
Yes, and when you think about it, too, the chair of the Democratic National Convention is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Jewish congresswoman from Florida. And it is a little mystifying that those who crafted the platform allowed this to happen.
Do you have a sense of why or how the passage was dropped? Who made that call?
Well, I'm not in Charlotte, but Natan Gutman, our Washington correspondent, is, and I've been talking extensively with him. Their argument, so let's just back up a little bit. In 2008, the words about Jerusalem were included in the Democratic platform, and the argument there was that it reflected the desires of policies for then candidate Obama and his wish to push the peace process forward. Some of the sources told Natan that the reason it was dropped in 2012 was actually so that there would be more emphasis on Israel's security and less on the peace process. And their argument was that this was something that both reflected the last 3 years of the Obama administration, and they thought, or they say they thought, this is what pro-Israel groups would want.
Dennis Kucinich, in that interview, said it's not up to the United States to say what the capital of Israel is. It's up to Israel to say what the capital of Israel is. So why does this matter to anybody if it's in the platform at all?
Well, I suppose you could say that about so many issues with the platform. I mean, I understand that argument very well, and in fact, I just had the opportunity moments ago to speak with Shlomo Mola, who is the deputy speaker of the Knesset in Israel, not a member of Netanyahu's party, a member of the Kadima party, but still very important person there, and he said the same thing. He said, we don't need Republicans or Democrats to tell us where our capital is, because we believe Jerusalem is our capital, and that's all that matters.
Elizabeth in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Elizabeth.
Yeah, hi. There was a speaker, I'm sorry I don't remember who it was, on Tuesday or Wednesday, who came right out and said that the Democrats had been way too spineless. And then they turned around and acted completely spineless on this platform committee stuff. This business about the capital of Israel being Jerusalem is just caving completely to AIPAC and Adelson and all the most right-wing forces here and in Israel. And the thing about inserting God into the platform really makes me furious because, A, it's disenfranchising atheists and agnostics, and B, it supports the right-wingers who in the last year or so have been just making up complete lies about the history of this country. Thomas Jefferson was a Unitarian. Tom Paine was an atheist. That nonsense on the dollar bills and the under God in the allegiance were both inserted in the 1950s to prove that we were not godless communists around the same time of the McCarthy hearings.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. And so taking Elizabeth's comments with some things that people in the more, you know, conservative parts of the Jewish community are saying, the Democrats, Jane, as a matter of political analysis here, risk coming out looking both soft on Israel for not including the language in the first place and susceptible to Jewish political pressure for reinserting it yesterday.
You're right. They do. And I think this really was an unnecessary mess for them. I think the sentiment that we just heard from Elizabeth was also evident in the hall. Again, Natan reported to me that it took three tries for this change in the platform language to be approved. And it's not really clear that there were actually two-thirds of the people in attendance who voted for it.
Well, hang on there for a second, because since you brought it up, we have a clip, because this change was done, as you say, by voice vote, and it took three tries before the convention chairman, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, declared that he had heard the requisite two-thirds majority to pass the amendment. But as you say, nobody was quite sure among the independent observers that that was the case. Let's listen to 25 seconds of audio from that third and final vote.
I'll do that one more time. All those delegates in favor say aye. All those delegates opposed say no. In the opinion of the chair, two-thirds have voted in the affirmative. The motion is adopted, and the platform has been amended as shown on the screen. Thank you very much.
Well, some of the delegates who voted no obviously didn't hear it as two-thirds. And the thing that we can't really know from that clip is where the mics were placed and whether they were closer to people who were voting no than voting yes. But again, certainly independent people who were there seemed to doubt that it was two-thirds at all. But the order seemed to come right from the top. This has been what's reported, that President Obama insisted that this vote be made. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is my understanding. And frankly, it was probably a political necessity for him to do this, as bad as it might look momentarily. You know, the bigger question here is how important are these platforms? Do we believe that at least two-thirds of all the Republicans attending their convention in Tampa agreed with every single line of their platform? I'm not sure. To me, what this issue points to in a broader sense is the insecurity that some of the Democrats still feel over Israel, over these kinds of issues, not with the majority of American Jews, but with the small number who haven't yet made up their mind and who are open to wooing from both sides.
Sammy in Hancock, New York. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sammy.
Yeah, good morning. My concern is, like, you have 10 to 15 million American Muslims, and we happen to be in all the swing states. Now, to insert such a provocative, unnecessary inclusion as to whether on a fake voice vote that Jerusalem should be the capital, I mean, this is going to alienate the Muslims, and we're just going to sit on the sideline, and the Republicans are going to win as a result.
From a purely political standpoint, probably very few Muslims at this point are going to vote Republican. You're saying the risk is they're going to sit on the sidelines.
Yes, because we are suppressed anyway, and with this alienation by the Democrats calling Jerusalem to be the capital, Jerusalem is the third holiest site for Muslims. And, a blanket permit. Just to come out and say on a fictitious vote.
It did have that.
It's an insult to Muslims.
Sammy, does it mollify you at all that the language did include the sentence, the parties have agreed that Jerusalem is a matter for final status negotiations, it should remain an undivided city accessible to people of all faiths. So since it says that in addition to Jerusalem is and will remain the capital of Israel, does that make it even-handed?
No, it's not even-handed because the latter part we didn't hear. We only heard the part that was Jerusalem is the capital endorsed by President Obama, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I've spoken to her, and I've asked her, what was the purpose of this? Because 80% of Israelis don't want Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel.
And Sammy, I don't know where that 80% number comes from or if we can verify it, but I appreciate your call. And we've just got 30 seconds left. Jane Eisner from the Jewish Daily Forward. Why, if this is such a vital issue, has no president, including President Bush, President Reagan, no Republican president, has moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
Because quite simply, it is the United States policy that the final status of Jerusalem is subject to negotiations. And there's a recognition in that should we move our capital there, we're bypassing those negotiations. And we ought not to do that. And every president, Republican and Democrat, has seen that the wisdom of that.
Sure.
And beyond the platform conversations, that still holds.
Jane Eisner, editor of the Jewish Daily Forward. Thanks a lot. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Our next guest, the Reverend Jesse Jackson from the Democratic Convention. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I had the opportunity to interview the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who's at the convention yesterday. I started by welcoming him to WNYC.
Good to be with you, and good to be with you in Charlotte, North Carolina, the scene of the Democratic Convention, and what amounts to a new South, and that's a good news story.
And let me flash back 4 years to begin. It was a moment that I'll never forget, just seeing you on television with a tear in your eye after the president's election. How has he done, in your opinion?
Well, he's done amazingly well against some tough odds. First of all, you must put his winning in context. It was a redemptive moment for America, given our history of race and racism. For us to rise above ancient fears and walls and to elect him was a deal that shook the world in a very positive sense. Secondly, he inherited a situation where we're in a deep hole, deeper than we understood. We lost 4 million jobs, 800,000 that month. We've gone from losing 4 million jobs to gaining 4 million. That's a sweep of 8 million jobs. That trajectory upward must be maintained. Secondly, the automotive industry was gone. We thought that only the Japanese or Germans could make the cars in a very special kind of way, but we bailed out the GM, and now we're number one in auto production again, running 3 shifts in Iowa and Ohio and Illinois, and that's very well. We were trapped in an expensive war in Iraq where we hit the wrong target, $1 to $3 trillion. Well, we're out of that war now. What could $1 trillion do today? Wipe out every state budget deficit, rehire every policeman, teacher, and fireman. If you look at his track record, he has a case to make for what he has done.
I read on Politico that you said you would like to hear more about poverty at the convention. Do you think President Obama has not focused enough on that in his administration?
Well, I think that the president and the competition and the Congress must deal with the crippling fact of 50 million Americans who are in poverty, 54 million who are food insecure, and 44 million on food stamps. Poverty undercuts the health care protection. It undercuts education. It undercuts our dreams. I would hope at some point, with so much focus on Ohio, 30 counties in Ohio are in Appalachia. What a great moment to revisit what President Johnson spoke of the war on poverty, University of Ohio at Athens, and revive a commitment to wipe out malnutrition and lift up the malnourished.
What would it look like in 2012, and where would the money come from?
Well, right now, we are paying for poverty. The money, it could come from excessive military spending. We threw away $3 trillion, $1 to $3 trillion on Iraq and was the wrong target. That was not a good use of our money. really investing in the poor is a money saver, because the people are becoming are productive, healthier bodies cost less than sick bodies. People with nutrition are more cost-effective than people who are malnourished. That's where the money would come from.
Reverend Jackson, there has been plenty of backlash, as you well know, to Obama policies like the stimulus and the health care law. How much of that do you think has been race-based as opposed to simply policy-based?
Well, the resistance to a comprehensive health care plan began even in the Roosevelt days. There was great resistance to the idea of Medicare and Medicaid during the Johnson days, and Social Security during the Roosevelt days. There's always been this resistance to it, expanding the safety net for people. Hillary Clinton was roundly attacked for trying to put forth a health care plan. So that part is not new. What's new is the level of demeaning rhetoric attacking them in such personal terms. You're not an American, they say. You were not born here. You are not a Christian. You are Muslim, they say in pejorative terms. You are a food stamp president. You are a welfare president. These veiled terms are full of race barking, and it's beneath the leaders who espouse it, and we must go to another level. He has, for his to lasting credit, kept a temperament above the pain of those hits, and those have been very painful and wrong hits.
Have you heard about the Dinesh D'Souza movie that posits that the president wants to weaken the United States from an anti-colonial mindset because he thinks this would be good for Kenya and other developing nations that are under the thumb of the United States? And do you have a reaction to Dinesh D'Souza?
It's foolishness not worth dignifying.
There are some commentators from the African-American community, like Tavis Smiley and Cornel West and Frederick Harris at Columbia, who think President Obama has not been explicit enough with policies that benefit the disparities between African-Americans and whites remaining today. What's your opinion about that?
We should all keep applying the pressure. And the president has competing forces for his attention. We must keep raising the issue of racial justice, because there's so much injustice, of too much violence, of too much poverty. Dr. King supported Kennedy over Nixon. We still had the march on Washington for public accommodations over President Kennedy's will. He supported Johnson over Goldwater. We still had the march in Selma for the right to vote when President Johnson didn't think it could happen. And so I say to every president, we have the right to apply pressure. Keep applying pressure for racial justice and gender equality and workers' rights. It's the normal thing to do, and it's the right thing to do.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, if I could get in two more questions before we run out of time. One is, you've brought up the military and the wars a couple of times. I'm curious if you think that the United States should seriously reconsider a draft. It's an issue that Congressman Rangel has pushed, as you know, and given the economic draft, as some people call it, given the fact that members of Congress almost never have their own family's blood in the bargain when they make a decision to go to war. Do you think that it's something the U.S. should seriously reconsider?
Absolutely. We should share the burden and share the glory. People ask, why have there been so few protests over the war in Iraq and the war in Afghan? Because so few people have some child or some family member in the game. It's basically a backdoor draft for a poor people's war. In the war in Vietnam, children were leaving Harvard and Yale, and some leaving Columbia and Ohio State. And because of the broader distribution of pain, the broader protest. And so we should all share equally in the burden and the glory of America.
Last question. I wonder if you could reflect for just a moment on the broad sweep of history through your lifetime. You, of course, worked with Dr. King. You ran for president yourself in 1984 and 1988. You were often referred to as a civil rights candidate at the time, language people did not use about Barack Obama in 2008. Talk to me about where we've come as a nation in your lifetime.
In the broad stroke, Reverend Congressman Bill Gray's father gave the invocation at the 1948 Democratic Convention. It made him the most exalted black preacher in America for giving the prayer at the 48th convention. here we are 60 years later, Barack Obama nominated the Democratic nominee and the winner of the election. In 60 years, that's the broad stroke. The broad stroke is the laws changed. We ended legal apartheid in 1954, the right to vote in 65, but we carried the nation with us. Let us not forget, in 65, blacks could not vote. Well, white women couldn't serve on juries in the South. 18-year-olds could not vote. Students could not vote on campuses, residency. You could not vote bilingually. We brought the nation to a higher ground, and we must go forward by that hope and not backwards by that fear. And I listen to people in the South speak that they are against federal involvement. These interstate highways is 90% federal and 10% state. These airports and seaports in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Charleston, South Carolina, that's federal. 45% of North Carolina's state budget is federal. 51% of Louisiana's state budget is federal. These states could not survive a week without federal investment. And why not? This land is our land. Forever choose a more perfect union for us all rather than states' rights for a few.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, thank you so much. In an interview that we recorded yesterday with Jackson at the Democratic Convention, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.